Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's December the 20th. This is a Hanukkah shiur. The topic of tonight's shiur is construction and renovation of a shul, a Hanukkah discussion. It is relevant to the Gemara that the Yesodei Torah groups are going to be starting right after we come back from our break on Gimel Amud Beis in Bava Basra, which will deal with a halacha of construction and renovation of a shul, and we'll see how relevant it is to today's day and age, and very relevant to possible types of construction and renovation that may be taking place in our immediate neighborhood. The connection to Hanukkah is also very strong in this Gemara. So we'll start with the halachos of the laws of construction and renovation of a shul, and then we'll see how that ties in with Hanukkah. The Gemara tells us in Bava Basra on Gimel Amud Beis, Rav Chisda says that one is not allowed to dismantle a shul with intention to build another shul. Meaning that if you have a shul in existence and you want to build another one, but in order to build the second one, you need either the materials from the first one, or you need money which you don't have, and in order to get the money you need to dismantle the first shul and sell the materials in order to get money, or you need a place to build. You don't have any land to build on, so you need to dismantle the first shul in order to have land to build the second shul. So the Gemara says that is prohibited. You're not allowed to take apart the first shul until you first construct the second shul. So even though it may be a financial strain, and even though it may be difficult to find land and material and whatever it is, you first have to construct the second shul, so you have a first shul in existence, construct the second one, it's fully constructed, then you can dismantle the first one. But you can't do it in the opposite order. That's what Rav Chisda says, and that is the baseline halacha. That applies to any shul, it applies to any base medrash. It applies to a shul or a base medrash that is publicly owned or privately owned. And it applies to when we are constructing a new shul. That means if we have to dismantle one to construct another. It applies to selling one shul to purchase another. So if we have an existing shul and we want to buy another one, but we need the money, so we'll sell the first one and then buy the second one. Can't do that. You have to buy the second one first, then you can sell the first one. Same rule. It even applies when you're renting. You have a lease on one building and you have that as a shul. So we want to open up a lease on another building. So we want to break one lease and open up another one. And we need the security deposit or whatever it is. Can't do that. You first have to start another lease, get another shul, and then you can break the first lease. So it's a very comprehensive halacha and applies across the board in these things. So that's very, very limiting for the construction of a new shul. You can't do it. You can't dismantle one till you build the other one. The Gemara has a machlokas, has two opinions as to why this is true. The halacha is true. The question is why. One opinion is, the reason is, because of pshiusa, of negligence. They were concerned that if the first shul is dismantled, perhaps the people will get complacent and never build the second shul, and the community will end up with no shul. That's one concern. There's another opinion that the concern is that there'll be no place to daven in the interim. We're not worried about negligence. We're not worried that if we take apart one, we won't construct the other one. But where are we going to daven in the interim? There's going to be several months, maybe a year, maybe longer, where there's no shul. Where are we going to daven? So because of that, you first have to establish a second shul before you dismantle the first one. Or buy a second one before you sell the first one. So Gemara says, what's the difference between these two opinions? The difference is, if you have another place to daven. Let's say you're going to take apart the first shul. And there's no other shul to daven in, but there's an auditorium. There's a school that has a large auditorium. Or there's a social hall. You could daven in the social hall. So you have a place to daven. So according to the opinion that says the reason is because we're afraid that there's no place to daven, you have a place to daven, it's no problem. But according to the opinion that says the reason is because of pshiusa, that you may be negligent and not end up constructing the second shul, then even if you have a place to daven in the interim, you're not allowed to do it. The halacha follows that opinion. The halacha follows the opinion that the reason why it is prohibited to dismantle the first one till we construct the second one, the reason is because of pshiusa, because of negligence. In which case, even if you have another place to daven in the interim, you're still not allowed to do it. So if you have a shul and you want to dismantle it and build another one, and you could find a place to daven, there's an auditorium, there's a social hall, it doesn't help. You're not allowed to dismantle the first one until you first construct the second one. The Mishnah Berurah makes it clear that that means the second one has to be fully constructed, fully ready to operate, before you begin to dismantle the first one. It can't be in the process of being built, it has to be completely built. Now that's all when it comes to dismantling and constructing. What about renovation? What about if we have a shul and we need to renovate it? We'd like to expand it, for example. So we want to break a wall down and build another one. Or we want to beautify it, so we need to take it apart or somehow and redo it. And it's going to be the type of renovation which is going to make the shul unusable for a certain amount of time. I'm not talking about where it's a quick, do something quickly in a few hours. But it's going to be something that's going to take a week or two, or longer, to do a renovation. The halacha is the same. One is not allowed to renovate a shul without first having another shul to daven in. And so if a renovation of an existing shul is going to render that shul unusable, it is prohibited to renovate the shul. So that means we have a nice building and it's usable and we're fine dominating the building, and we decide, you know what, we'd like to change the windows. We don't like how the windows are, and we don't like how the seating is, and we don't like just for argument's sake, we don't like the stadium seating, and we want to level it off. And in order to do that, we're going to have to move out of the shul and move into a temporary place, like for example, maybe a social hall or something like that. That would be prohibited. One is not allowed to do that because there is an interim time where you do not have a functioning shul. You do have a place to daven, but it's not a shul that you're davening in. Just because you're in the shul building doesn't make it a shul. It's not a sanctuary, and therefore it would be prohibited to do it. That's the baseline halacha. Now, of course, like with any halacha, there are exceptions, and it is within the exceptions where we find ways of doing these things. So the Gemara itself presents three exceptions. And these are very, very important for us to know, because the exceptions are going to be the ways that we're going to find out how we can do it. The three exceptions, which I'll tell you in a moment, the first one is universally accepted. The second one is the subject of a machlokes, it's a debate, but the Mishnah Berurah and others say that we can rely on the lenient opinion. And both those two exceptions are very relevant, as you'll see. Both can be applied in many cases today. The third exception to this rule is not very relevant today, but it is very relevant to Hanukkah. So that's what we're about to do. We're going to give you three exceptions to this rule. The first two are going to help us for possible construction or renovation that can be done in our places of davening. And the third one, which won't be so relevant to us, but is very relevant to the Yontif of Chanukah, which we are beginning this evening. So the first exception, the Gemara tells us, is Chazi Batiyua. Literally, that means that if you see in the structure of the shul a weakness, so we see some sort of structural damage in the shul, then this rule doesn't apply. If the shul has some sort of structural damage, then the halacha is one can immediately dismantle the first shul in order to build the second shul. That would mean that there's some sort of a, let's say there's an earthquake or something like that, causes a structural damage in the shul. So we need to build another one. But the only way to build the other one is by either selling or taking material from the first one. then it is permitted to dismantle the first one in order to build the second one. Now, when the Gemara says that chazi batiyua, that a structural damage is enough of a reason to forego this rule, clearly the Gemara does not mean a case where the roof is falling down on people's heads. Because if it's like that, you don't need the Gemara to tell you that. You're not allowed to walk into a building where it's dangerous to be. Doesn't matter if it's a shul or anything else. You're not allowed to walk into a dangerous place. So clearly, the Gemara, when it says chazi batiyua, that it's a place that has a structural damage, it doesn't mean the building's about to collapse. But it means that the building is showing signs where it can turn dangerous eventually, so we need to do something about it. In that case, one is allowed to immediately begin dismantling the first shul in order to build the second shul. Now, this idea of chazi batiyua, of seeing structural damage, the poskim really, and the Gemara itself, expand it to cases beyond structural damage. I'll give you an example. The Taz writes about a case that he himself ruled on, where there was a Jewish community that used to live outside of the city limits that they were near. The city had a wall around it. Over time, the Jews migrated into the city, inside the wall of the city. And the community slowly but surely moved into the city, the opposite of what happens today. And as that was happening, the shul building, of course, remained outside the city. And so the community began moving in, and now they were inside the wall of the city, but the shul building became more and more inaccessible because it was outside the wall of the city, which means you had to get through the gate, and whatever it is, it was not such an easy thing to get to shul and back. So the Taz writes, that is the same as chazi batiyua. That's like finding structural damage. He says there's no greater structural damage than that. If you can't get to shul, that's structural damage. And therefore, in that case, the Taz writes, immediately you can dismantle the first shul in order to build a new shul inside the wall of the city. So you see expansion of this idea of chazi batiyua, finding a structural problem with the shul. The Gemara tells the case of a shul, of a community that had a winter shul and a summer shul. The HVAC being what it was in those days, the system for summer and winter was not as simple as switching the switch from heat to cool. It was a question of how many windows the building had, how high or low the ceiling was, various changes. And the Gemara says that they were allowed to dismantle one in order to construct the other. Now, it's not clear, and there's a debate about this, whether the Gemara is talking about the same building, meaning the same building was transformed from a winter building to a summer building and back again, or whether there were two buildings, but you needed material from one in order to prepare the second one for its season. Either way, the Gemara says it's permissible to dismantle the winter shul in the springtime in order to prepare the summer shul, and vice versa in the fall to dismantle the summer shul in order to prepare the winter shul, even though there's an interim period where neither one is functioning. So the Gemara says that's permitted. And most of the poskim say that the reason is, or I should say not most of the poskim say, but there are some that say, Tosfos himself says this, that the reason is because temperature control is an example of chazi batiyua, of finding structural damage. A shul that is too hot in the summer or too cold in the winter is akin to a shul with structural damage. And if in order to fix the HVAC, you need to move out of the building and it's not going to be usable for several days, it's still permitted because that's like structural damage. So here we have a very interesting exception, and each case would have to be taken on a case-by-case basis to decide whether the problem that's being addressed is tantamount to structural damage. Perhaps if a shul has too many steps and the congregation is older and unable to take those steps so easily, maybe that's similar to chazi batiyua. Maybe that would permit moving out of the building in order to renovate it, even though there's going to be a time where there's no shul to daven in, where the davening in a makeshift place. Perhaps that would be an exception to the rule. Or If it's the kind of thing where besides the heating and air isn't working so well, maybe the lighting isn't working well, or something like that, these sorts of things perhaps would fall under the exception of chazi batiyua, of there being some sort of structural damage. That's not going to help for something aesthetic. Just because it doesn't look so nice, that's not structural damage. But that's one exception. The second exception is a matter of debate between the Taz and the Magen Avraham. The Taz is Mako, he's the lenient opinion. The Magen Avraham is Machmir, he's the stringent opinion. And there are various others who take sides. And as I said at the outset, the Mishnah Berurah rules leniently in this debate. The second exception is that although we said that even if you have another place to daven, like in an auditorium or a social hall, it is still prohibited to dismantle the first shul in order to construct the second one. But if you have another shul to daven in, it would be permitted. If there's another full-fledged, functioning sanctuary that can be davened in, then this rule doesn't apply, according to the Taz. Then this rule doesn't apply. So for example, if you have a shul, and the shul doesn't only have one sanctuary, there is a daily minyan, there is a kol beis medrash, there are other shuls across the street and down the block that could be large enough all together, all these different shuls together are large enough. There's a shul in Torah Day School. If the shuls are large enough, theoretically, to accommodate everyone, then the Taz holds, and the Mishnah Berurah says we rule this way, it is permitted to do construction on the shul despite the fact that it will be unusable for a period of time. That would be permitted. Because you're not forcing people to daven in a makeshift place. There are real sanctuaries, real places that are real shuls that are available. Now, here's a very important point. You could set up a makeshift place to daven. You're not required to go to other shuls or other sanctuaries in the same complex to daven in. It's just that you're not allowed to do the construction unless theoretically there are enough shuls to accommodate the congregation. But once there are enough shuls and sanctuaries to accommodate the congregation, then you could make a makeshift minyan in a social hall or in an auditorium. That would be fine. It's just that you can't rely only on that. There's got to be, theoretically, the possibility of everybody fanning out to different shuls. So according to this opinion, according to the Taz, and according to this exception, the reason for the construction is irrelevant. It doesn't have to be chazi batiyua. It doesn't have to be a structural damage. It could even be aesthetic. You want to repaint. You want to do the carpeting. Whatever it is. You want to change something that's going to take a little while to do. It's all right. Because people can daven in other shuls, other sanctuaries. And that's fine. And then you could even set up a makeshift place to daven. That'd be fine too. So according to this opinion, that would be fine as well. So those are the two major exceptions which shuls rely upon when they do construction, when they do renovation, when they have to close down a sanctuary for a certain amount of time in order to do what they're doing. It becomes more of a problem if you're the only shul in town. If it's the only shul, the only sanctuary in the city, and there is no place else to go, then it becomes a little bit more difficult, because then you don't have the second exception, you only have the first one of chazi batiyua, of some sort of a structural issue, which is a little bit harder to make work. But those are the two main exceptions. The third exception, which the Gemara says, is a Hanukkah-related exception. And in order to appreciate this, I'm going to give you the background information, which is going to involve the story that is told in the Gemara Bava Basra, which we will all learn, please God, in a week or two. But it also is broader than that. It's got more history besides what the Gemara tells, both before and after the place where the Gemara picks up the storyline. So let me give you the general background, which of course includes the Hanukkah story. Now you know the Hanukkah story takes place during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash was constructed under Persian rule. We know that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, and then during the time of our exile in Babylonia, the Babylonians were defeated by the Persians, who took over the entire known world at that time. And it is under the Persians, after the Purim story, that we were given permission by Daryavesh, who was the son of Ahasuerus and Esther, to rebuild the temple, to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, to build the second Beis HaMikdash. The truth is, the Jews started building it before they had permission, and then they were granted permission to do it. A side point, which will become relevant in a moment, is that the truth is, the Jews were given permission to rebuild it 18 years earlier by Koresh, the King Koresh, which precedes the Purim story. They were given permission by Koresh to build. They laid the foundation, and then they were caused to stop. They were made to stop the building because the people living in Israel went to Koresh, the king, and told him that the Jews are out to rebel against you, and therefore the construction was stopped. An interesting side note, as the women who come to my shir in Sefer Ezra know, an interesting side note is one of the leaders of those non-Jews living in Israel at that time that stopped the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash was one of Haman's sons. And he was one of the ones who made up a story that the Jews were out to rebel. Be that as it may, the construction was stopped for 18 years. During that 18 years, the Purim story occurs. After the 18 years are over, the Jews build the second Beis HaMikdash. Now they were the people who led the building of the second Beis HaMikdash were Zerubbabel, which you might know from the Moses Tzur that we sing on Hanukkah. Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel. It's one word, Zerubbabel, not Zerubbabel. Right? It's one word, Zerubbabel. It's a person's name. He was the leader of the Jewish people, and his other name is Nehemiah, as in the book of Ezra, Nehemiah. Zerubbabel is also Nehemiah, same person. He was the son of King Yechaniah. Yechaniah was the second to last Jewish king before the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. He was taken to Babylonia and put in a dungeon for many, many years. And his son is Zerubbabel, is Nehemiah. In other words, he is really the heir to the throne. Now, we didn't have kings in the second Beis HaMikdash, but he would have been the king if we would have had kings in the second Beis HaMikdash. We didn't have kings because we were under the control of the Persians when we built. But he would have been it. That was Zerubbabel, and he was instrumental in constructing the second Beis HaMikdash. His partner in construction of the second Beis HaMikdash was Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. This is not the same Yehoshua as the disciple of Moshe, who took the Jews into Israel. This is many years later. Yehoshua, who is a Kohen, the Yehoshua who is Moshe's disciple, was from the tribe of Ephraim. This is a different Yehoshua, Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. And if you're careful to look in the Haftorah this coming Shabbos, you will see mention of Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. He's talked about in this week's Haftorah. So Yehoshua was the one who was helping with the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. He was the grandson of the last Kohen Gadol of the first Beis HaMikdash. And he becomes the first Kohen Gadol of the second Beis HaMikdash. Those are the two who spearhead the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Ezra, who is also a Kohen, doesn't come to Israel until the second Beis HaMikdash is already constructed. He's not involved in the construction. Those are the two who spearhead it. The Jews construct the second Beis HaMikdash. They're under Persian rule. Eventually, the Persians are conquered by, who knows? By the Greeks, by Alexander. They conquer the Persians, and they become the dominant power in the world. They take over the known world. Now the Jews are under Greek rule. The Greek Empire fractures into several parts upon the death of Alexander, and Israel then alternately becomes under the rule either of the Syrian Greeks or we'll call them the Egyptian Greeks, the Ptolemy kings of Egypt, who were also Greeks, who took over that part of the Alexander the Great's empire, of the Greek Empire. And Israel was often changed hands between those two parties. The Hanukkah story takes place during the time when we were under the Syrian Greeks and Antiochus. That's when they were trying very hard to to destroy our religion, and they wanted us to assimilate. Many Jews did assimilate. Those are the Misyavnim, the Hellenists. And the Jews then, led by Matthew ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who was a Kohen, and his sons, who became the Maccabees, they are the ones who led us in the battle against the Syrian Greeks, against all odds. As you know, the Hanukkah story, tremendous miracles. And over a period of years and many battles, we were able to defeat the Syrian Greeks and chase them out along. And also the Jews who had assimilated were also defeated and chased out, the Hellenists, the Misyavnim. And the Beis HaMikdash was rededicated. It had been defiled during the time of the Syrian Greeks. And we were able to rededicate it. The miracle of the Hanukkah menorah, of the lights, takes place during these years of fighting. And at the end of this whole thing, we actually enjoy a period of autonomy for the first time, first and only time, during the second Beis HaMikdash era. There was a period of autonomy. The Persians weren't in control of us, the Greeks weren't in control of us, and the Romans hadn't come in yet. So there was this window where the Jews had a period of autonomy. Who's going to lead us during that time? Well, the Hashmonaim, who were Kohanim, had won the war, and they commanded a great deal of respect amongst the Jewish people. And they were also Talmidei Chachamim, they were sages as well. And therefore, they assumed a role as interim leaders, because someone had to lead the country. Over time, what should have happened is that they should have ceded their authority to who? Who should then take over? To the house of David HaMelech, the descendants of King David, the house from the tribe of Yehuda. In other words, the descendants of Zerubbabel, of Nehemiah, they should have been the ones to take the command from the Kohanim, from the Hashmonaim. But the Hashmonaim did not relinquish their position of authority and leadership. They didn't give it up to the tribe of Yehuda, to the line of Beis David. As a result, a few generations later, after the Hanukkah story, tragedy occurs, and that's what the story in Bava Basra discusses. There actually was civil war amongst the Hashmonai leaders after a few generations. They, one of them actually brought the Romans in to help him against his brother who he was warring with. That gave the Romans a foothold in Israel. And they eventually became the dominant force, and we were no longer autonomous. We were now under Roman rule, and eventually the Romans destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash. When the Greeks had when the Hashmonaim had this period of time that they were in control where they should not have been, they should have given up the authority, then the Gemara tells us that they were punished. The Ramban and Chumash explains that this was a punishment because they didn't relinquish control to the tribe of Yehuda like they should have. And the Gemara tells us that Hurdus, that's Herod, was a slave of the Hashmonaim, and he heard a baskol, he had some sort of a divine inspiration, that it was a good idea for him to rebel. And he did, he rebelled. Apparently he had some military strength behind him, and he overcame his masters, the Hashmonaim, and murdered all of them in cold blood. Wiped out the entire family of Hashmonaim, except for one girl. He left one girl alive. Why did he leave one girl alive? Because Hurdus had a problem. He was a slave. And he wanted to be king. A slave can't be king. He doesn't have any legitimacy. In order to establish his legitimacy, he wanted to marry this one girl from the Hashmonai line. The Hashmonai were acting as kings. If he would marry this one girl, that would give him legitimacy. And then he could assume the throne. When this girl realized what happened, she went up on the roof, and the Gemara relates that she called out, "If anybody ever comes in the future and says, I descend from the house of Hashmonai, that famous hero family of Israel, I descend from the Hashmonai family, you should know he's a slave. He's not a legitimate Jew, he's a slave. Because the only ones left are this evil slave, Hurdus, and me, and this young girl. And I'm about to jump off the roof." And she jumped off the roof and killed herself, leaving only Hurdus, only a slave. And the Gemara says this is in fact the case. If anybody comes and claims and wants to show up and say, you know who I come from? I come from the Hashmonaim. That's nothing to show off about. That means the person is a descendant of slaves. Now Hurdus needed legitimacy, because now there was no girl to marry from the Hashmonai family. What was he going to do? So he said to himself, who's going to question my legitimacy? Not the rank and file of the Jews. They don't know so much. Who's going to question my legitimacy? The sages. The Talmidei Chachamim. And so Herod went on a rampage and murdered all of the leading Talmidei Chachamim, the leading sages of the time. He didn't kill the up-and-coming younger Talmidei Chachamim, the younger sages. And he left alive one elder sage. Why did he leave alive one elder sage? For the same reason everybody wants to have a Jew in their cabinet. Because he needed some advice. So he wanted someone to get some real advice from. So he left alive Bava ben Buta, who was one of the great sages. One of the great students of Shammai. And he left alive Bava ben Buta. And he kept him for advice, but he didn't want Bava ben Buta gathering the Jews together to oust him. So he wanted to confine Bava ben Buta. So he blinded him. He made him blind. And now he had Bava ben Buta available for advice, but Bava ben Buta really couldn't be any kind of rallying cry for the Jewish people. So Hurdus now had control of the kingdom. He had wiped out the Hashmonaim completely. He had wiped out the leading sages of the generation, except for Bava ben Buta, who he blinded, and now he had control. And this went on for several years. Eventually, Hurdus wanted to test the loyalty of Bava ben Buta. And so, the Gemara relates that he goes to Bava ben Buta. Of course, Bava ben Buta can't see. So he goes to Bava ben Buta, and he pretends to be someone who is disgruntled with this Hurdus king. And he goes before him, and he sits before him, and he starts bad-mouthing the king, trying to see if Bava ben Buta will join in to the bad-mouthing of the king. And he won't take the bait. Bava ben Buta won't do it. He says, I'm afraid the king might hear. I don't want to say anything. And he keeps trying to convince him, don't worry, I'm the only one here. Nothing's going to happen. No, I can't do it. I can't do it. And he refuses. Eventually, Hurdus sees it's not going to happen. And he realizes the sages are actually very careful with their words. They don't just go blabbing. They're very careful how they speak and what they speak about. And they're particular. So he says to Bava ben Buta, I'm Hurdus. I didn't realize how careful the sages are with their speech. If I would have known that, I never would have murdered all of them. Because I had nothing to worry about. I didn't realize who I was dealing with. And Hurdus had remorse. He had a measure of remorse for having wiped out all of the sages. Not for having wiped out the Hashmonaim, but for having wiped out the sages. So he says to Bava ben Buta, what can I possibly do to make up for what I did? Is there any teshuva? Is there any repentance I can do? So Bava ben Buta said to him, you extinguished the light of the world because you murdered the sages. You need to go and do something to increase the light of the world. You have to get involved in the light of the world, which would mean the Beis HaMikdash. Go and renovate the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash at the time was looking a little drab. Go and do something to make it beautiful. So Hurdus said to Bava ben Buta, I want to do it. I'm ready to do it. But I'm afraid I'm going to start doing it. The Romans, who I'm really under their control, they're going to find out and they're going to stop me. So Bava ben Buta told him, he is a sage, he said, look, this is what you do. You send a messenger to Rome, from Israel to Rome. It's going to take him about a year to get there. It's a long trip. When he's there, he's got to go through red tape and meet with people, etc. And he's got to talk about, is it okay for you to go through this renovation project of the Beis HaMikdash? It'll take him a year to go through all that red tape up there in Rome. Then, they're going to tell him, no. And it's going to take him a year to get back to you. By that time, it'll be 3 years, you'll have finished the project. So that's what he does. And he goes through his Bava ben Buta's plan. And the Romans, they were no fools, they sent the message back as follows. They said, If you haven't started the construction, the renovation, don't do it. If you've dismantled the Beis HaMikdash and haven't yet rebuilt, leave it as is. And if you've already dismantled it and rebuilt it, you're a lousy slave that you first do something and then you ask permission whether you can do it or not. So that's what happened. And he managed to rebuild the temple. To do a renovation project on the temple. And the Gemara says, it was such a beautiful job, anybody who's never seen the building of Hordus has never seen a beautiful building in his life. He made the walls out of altering stones of different types of marble, and the sages even told him, don't cover it with gold, because it's so beautiful, it looks like the waves of the ocean. If you look at the wall of the Beis HaMikdash, it looked like it was moving. It was such a beautiful job. That's what he did. That's the story of Hordus. Eventually, of course, many years later, the Romans do destroy the second Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara asks, how could Bava ben Buta, who was a sage, how could he tell Hordus to do a renovation project on the Beis HaMikdash? If you're going to do a renovation project on the Beis HaMikdash, you're going to have to dismantle a wall or two or three and then construct those walls, which means there's a period of time when the Beis HaMikdash is not fully functional. Then you can't tell me there's another place to do the Beis HaMikdash. There is no other place to do the Beis. This is the only place. So how is it permitted for Bava ben Buta to tell Hordus to do this dismantling and then building of the Beis HaMikdash? It should be the problem that Rav Chisda says in our Gemara. You're not allowed to do that. So the Gemara answers a very important answer. Shani Malchus. The king, the throne, is different. Because when the king says he's going to do something, it gets done. As the Gemara says in its very descriptive tone, if the king says we're going to uproot a mountain, the mountain will get uprooted. The king will find a way to do it. When you're dealing with a king, we're not worried about pshiusa. We're not worried that it'll get derailed. That you'll dismantle and you won't get around to building the second one. If the king says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And you don't have to worry about it. This is the third exception. If a king says that we're going to do it, you're allowed to dismantle the shul, or the Beis Medrash, or the Beis HaMikdash, and then rebuild. That's okay. The Gemara asks another question, though. The Gemara asks, why did Bava ben Buta give good advice to an evil king, to Hordus? We do find precedent. We find that Daniel, who gave good advice to Nebuchadnezzar, was punished because he should not have given good advice to an evil king. Why does Bava ben Buta offer good advice to an evil king, to Hordus? And the Gemara answers, in this case it was acceptable. Why? Because without the intervention of a king, there's no way for the Beis HaMikdash to be constructed or renovated. You need a king to get involved. And so here, there was no way to improve the Beis HaMikdash, which really needed improving. It was impossible to do it without involving the king. And therefore, it was acceptable for Bava ben Buta to give good advice to Hordus, because the result was the Beis HaMikdash. That's the story. Now, I want you to think about this, and I want you to take this with you for all 8 nights of Hanukkah. Think about this. The Chashmonaim, who were the heroes of the Hanukkah story, the Ramban writes beautiful things about the Chashmonaim, about how wonderful they were. That without them, the Torah would have been forgotten from the Jewish people, without their heroism in the Hanukkah story. And yet, because they violated this rule of the kingship being held by the line of King David, because of that, they were destroyed. They were wiped out by Hordus. In the end, though, what happens? Hordus wipes them out. He wipes out the sages. He has this incident with Bava ben Buta. And then he constructs or renovates the Beis HaMikdash to the point where it's more beautiful than ever. It was more beautiful than Shlomo's Beis HaMikdash. It was more beautiful than any building anybody ever made. So in the end, indirectly, the Chashmonaim are the cause for the Beis HaMikdash being renovated and made more beautiful than ever. Despite the fact that it came through a terrible tragedy, That is what ended up happening. Which leads me to believe that ultimately the Hashmonaim really would have gotten there anyway. Had they given over the reins to the house of David, like they should have, it would have eventually come out that the Hashmonaim would have somehow affected a renovation of the Beis HaMikdash. That was their tachlis, that was their goal, that was their aim in life. They would have been responsible for that. But they didn't do it correctly. They held on to the throne, and as a result they were wiped out. But still, the renovation took place. It's interesting that the Gemara, when it's discussing the Hashmonaim, who were Kohanim, but it's discussing the Beis HaMikdash, which is the place that the Kohanim serve, but the Gemara is fixated with what? With Malchus, with royalty. Not with Kohuna, not with the priesthood. The Kohanim, the Hashmonaim, should have relented, should have given up the royalty. They didn't. They were taken over by a slave who needs legitimacy as king. The reason why Bava ben Buta was able to give him the advice to renovate the Beis HaMikdash is because he's a king. And a king, we're not worried about this rule about dismantling and constructing. And you need a king, the Gemara says, in order to renovate the Beis HaMikdash. Without a king, it won't happen. It's all about royalty. Which brings us back to a very important point to remember. Today, we are in Galus, we are in exile. Of the three crowns of the Jewish people, that is royalty, priesthood, and Torah, we have the crown of Torah, Baruch Hashem, we have Talmidei Chachamim. We do not have a functioning king, and we do not have a functioning crown of Kohuna. We have Kohanim, but we have no Beis HaMikdash for them to serve it. So we don't have a functioning king, nor do we have a functioning crown of Kohuna. When Mashiach comes, B'mherav Yomenu, those two crowns will be restored. Mashiach himself is a king. He will be the descendant of David HaMelech. He's the king. And one of the jobs that a king has is to construct the Beis HaMikdash. It's the king's job to construct the Beis HaMikdash where the Kohanim will serve, restoring the crown of the Kohuna. When the second Beis HaMikdash was built, it was built by a team of, as we mentioned before, Zerubbabel, who is the line of King David, and Yehoshua Kohen Gadol from the Kohanim. The two together, when they were in Bavel, in exile just like we are today, they didn't have those two crowns either functioning. And when the Beis HaMikdash was constructed, the second Beis HaMikdash, those two together built the second Beis HaMikdash. In the time of the Hashmonaim, we were going from being under the rule, under the thumb of a foreign country, first the Persians, then the Greeks, and we were gaining autonomy. That should have been a time when both those crowns were restored, where the Kohanim, the Beis HaMikdash, was going to become more beautiful, and more beautiful than it had ever been before, which symbolizes the crown of the Kohuna reaching a higher level, and also the royalty should have been given over to the house of Beis David, where the crown of royalty also should have assumed or reassumed its position. That's what should have happened. Because together, those two crowns need to come into existence. It didn't happen. The Hashmonaim held on to the royalty. They were wiped out, decimated, destroyed. As if the Hanukkah story itself was being reversed. When we celebrate Hanukkah, and we recall what the Hashmonaim did, as the Ramban writes, the heroism of the Hashmonaim, the incredible thing that they did, that they preserved everything. Without them, everything would have been lost. They preserved everything. And they were the family of Kohanim, those great people. And we yearn for the time of Mashiach, when the Beis HaMikdash will be constructed again, and we will have the menorah being lit in the Beis HaMikdash, where the original miracle took place. It's the two crowns together that need to come into existence. It's the crown of Kohuna, who serve in the Beis HaMikdash, and it's the crown of Malchus in the embodiment of Mashiach, who will be the king. Those two are what we are lacking, and those are the two things that need to come into existence. We have the crown of Torah. Those two are what we yearn for and what we commemorate, really, with Hanukkah. Not only the crown of Kohuna, but also the crown of Malchus as well. Everyone should have a Freilich Hanukkah.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.